Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Rad Gontos, where is he? He's still there somewhere out wandering the world, wandering the freeways. As anyone knows who listens to the show, Rod always comes racing in at the last minute here. But we want to thank Dr. And was it John Geis? I forgot already now here.
Yes, that's correct.
John Geis, like nice Geis, who was Physician of the Year and certainly one of the more innovative practices I've ever heard of. Doing mobile geriatric care. Tell us what the heck that is.
Hi. Well, thank you, first of all, for having me here at OC Talk Radio. It really is a pleasure to be here with you guys. And something I love to talk about is what we do out in the geriatric world and what we do to try to help people and grow our practice.
Here's a geriatric host who just wandered in. He was out lost. He wasn't quite sure where he was today here.
So. I was navigating by the sun and the stars.
Exactly. We just opened up, and we're just asking him. This gentleman was Physician of the Year for a very innovative practice on geriatric medicine.
I was in the room when he received it.
You were? Okay. Well, cool. So he's just about to start telling us what the heck that is and how he started it.
So Geis Med is something that I had this idea about 4.5 years ago as I was working in a number of nursing homes. And seeing the quality of care that was being provided, and not just the quality of care, but the level of personal relationships that were being developed between the physician and the patient. And I really saw something that was lacking, and I saw something where there was an opportunity to create something better and an opportunity to really help these people. And so that's really, you know, where it started. And from there, I came back to my hometown in Fullerton, California, where I grew up, and I literally just started my own practice. I started going into every senior living community that I knew of in the area and offering my services, telling them that I would be back the next week and the week after that and the week after that, and that I would be coming there to help their senior residents to provide better primary care services.
Now, how do you get in, though? And I'll let Rod jump in, but I know that from many years of my parents in and out of nursing home facilities and skilled nursing facilities until they finally died, until they passed away, as people like to say, they couldn't have their own primary come in. Once they were behind those walls, the doctors could no longer come in and see them. It was only whoever the physician was that was part of that facility could see them.
Well, I think one of the things you want to differentiate to just kind of have a little background is, you have skilled nursing facilities, which are funded through Medicare and patient insurance.
Right.
And then you have assisted living and senior living communities.
Oh, I got it. Okay, right.
Which are private pay, cash pay, actual residences of seniors. So we actually have patients who approach us and who are referred to us in both settings. So if they are in a skilled nursing facility, then we are assigned to be the attending physician by the facility. But it is, at the end of the day, it is patient and family choice. So the better our reputation is and the better we do as primary care physicians, we have more family members and patients requesting us to be their primary care physician within the skilled nursing facility. Then at assisted living facilities or assisted living communities, as they preferred to be called, we go in and we market our services and we build relationships with the administrators, with the marketing directors, with the nurses, down to the med techs and every staff within the community. And from there, they get to know us and they get to know our personality and our compassion and our vision and drive to help these folks and see how sincere we are and what we want to do. And from there, they continue to refer and explain our services to family members one at a time. And we slowly gain a presence within those communities as the primary care physician.
Well, let me ask you this question. It sounds to me like when you get into that point in your life where you are now basically that is your primary residence, your primary care physician that you may have had may not be an option, right?
That is correct. We have several residents who initially want to meet us and learn about what we do and what we're about, but they do have a long-time primary care physician that maybe was their doctor for 40 or 50 years.
Right.
But what happens is typically that physician does not make house calls and does not come into the senior living community.
Oops, sorry.
So that physician does not make house calls or come into the senior living community. And then on top of that, oftentimes residents have been moved to a senior living community that's closer to their sons or daughters. And now their primary care physician is
miles away,
is either 20 minutes, 45 minutes, or a state away.
Right. And the reason I mentioned that, it's interesting that you actually made even a distinction between the type of facilities and how they get paid for. It kind of hit me that we've had people here talking about housing options. And I think this is the very first time that somebody has been that succinct with the difference. Because based on the type of facility, that then impacts other things such as primary care physician choice, the ability to how to go about it. But you're absolutely correct. I mean, in many cases, people are being moved to areas where maybe it's convenient for their, you know, loved one, their children, whatever, and now they're not even within proximity.
That's exactly right.
But we don't. It's really funny. It doesn't get mentioned. Like the assumption is, I'm going to move into there. My life isn't going to change when it comes to my primary physician. A, the primary physician may not be one that does house calls. And B, you may not even be in within the proximity of where your primary physician is to begin with.
That's exactly
right. And
can
I give you a third case? We're going through this with my 93-year-old aunt right now. Not only is she should be in an assisted living, but she can't afford it. So she's basically living in a little tiny apartment on her little tiny pension, a couple thousand a month. And basically homebound, and we bring in people to help. Meals on Wheels gives her food, and a nurse comes to see her once a week, and somebody, you know, helps her do her clothes and laundry and all this stuff. She would benefit by this because she can't get to her primary caregiver. She doesn't drive anymore. There's nobody to take her to see the doctor. And what happened when she had a little pension? She was a secretary with an insurance company. She gets what nobody gets today, a little pension for life. They didn't know it was going to be for 40 or 50 years. She's been on this pension, stopped working 40 years ago. She's 93 now. And her company just dropped her and said, I know we promised you we were going to give you this for life. No more. You live too long. And she got dropped, so we had to move her to a Medicare Advantage plan, which is no payment required, but it's an HMO. So she had a double whammy. She couldn't get to her primary oncologist that's been keeping her alive because she has this rare form of blood cancer. She couldn't get to him anymore because she couldn't drive. And her company that she retired from 40 years ago cut her off and said, we're not going to pay for your Blue Cross plan anymore. You're done. And therefore, he wasn't part of the HMO. So for two reasons, she had to find a new physician, and we're still struggling with that.
Well, you know, and I'm not going to say this just because I'm on your radio show. But what you just described is actually the main motivation by why I created a second, how would you say, practice within my practice, which is we have a managed care program within Geis Med, which is our mobile medical group. Mm-hmm. So when I started going into these assisted living communities about 3.5-4 years ago, half of the patients belong to managed care insurance plans. Mm-hmm. And typically...
An HMO, where you got to stay within their group, right?
An HMO. And typically, it's very difficult for those patients to receive regular, continuous care from a visiting house call physician. So, over the last year and a half, I've been working with a management entity and with Medicare attorneys and whatnot. And we've actually been approved by Medicare, and we have our own IPA, which is a managed care plan, HMO, if you will, that's contracted with Medicare through a health plan called Brand New Day. And because of that, we can now perform house calls for patients such as your family member who is an HMO, who's in home. And so we're actually gaining patients every week and every month who fall into that category. So for the first time since I've started doing this, I can really offer our services to any patient, regardless of what the insurance is, whether they have traditional Medicare or they belong to an HMO.
What about regardless where they may be residing, or is it only to assisted living and
homes? We do a lot of house calls. So we literally go out to the individual homes and visit our patients.
You can't go in. If my aunt went into skilled nursing tomorrow, you couldn't come in and see her, right?
No.
Unless you were contracted with that facility.
No, yes, I could. See, the skilled nursing facility is relatively easy to become contracted with. It only takes about 24 hours. I just have to send them over my credentials. And chances are, if it's within, 40 square miles of here, I probably am contracted with that facility.
Mm-hmm. Because we were told, this is news to me, we were told repeatedly, my mother had Parkinson's. She went in and out of skilled nursing for many years until she died. My dad went in and out of skilled nursing facilities for many years until he died. And Medicare only pays for 30 days. So you fall, you go to the hospital, they get you out as quick as they can once you're stable, and you go to a skilled nursing facility to try and get stable. And then they send you home, whether you're ready or not, because Medicare only pays 30 days generally in these facilities. It may be a little longer if you can show some improvement, but we always saw 30 was kind of the magic number. Now, during those 30 days, their doctors would always say, I can't come see you when you're in there. I'm sorry, I'm not admitted or whatever. I can't.
So typically what happens is, it's not to take anything away from the physician who's following that patient, who is the primary care physician outside of the facility. But typically what happens, that facility or that physician does not have the time or ability to go to all the different skilled nursing facilities. So they usually will tell their patients from the regular practice, I apologize, I don't regularly go to that skilled nursing
facility. So they could have if they wanted to, but they lied to us and said, can't do it.
Well, but it's
not that they lied. Yeah. It's just not feasible. So when I first started, before I formed my own company and started building a mobile geriatric house call type practice, mm-hmm. I started seeing patients in an office setting. It's very difficult to see patients Monday through Friday in an office setting and go out to multiple skilled nursing facilities after hours, on weekends, and this and that. And when you're in the skilled nursing facility, the facility typically has quite a few demands. They want the physician to be available by phone every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They want visits two or three times a week, and so on and so forth. So you really have to have a practice geared towards focusing strictly on that type of patient.
And that's what I was going to say, Paul. It's not it's not the lying. Is that which business practice did you set up? Because you'd have to commit to this mobile concept, and that is what you do, and not try to bridge,
But understand how horrible,
one leg in one camp
horrible
one
it is for the patient. My father's elderly, my aunt's elderly, my mom is elderly. They've had a traumatic incident. They've been in the hospital. They had a heart attack. They had surgery. They fell, usually. And now they've been brought to a skilled nursing facility because the hospitals can only keep you for a short period of time on Medicare. And so they move you as quickly as they can, as quickly as you stabilize. Even if you're not good, even if you're in a coma or whatever, they'll move you into a skilled nursing facility as quickly as they can. And
let's
now,
just put it this way. It's bad enough of a problem that there's a rule now on readmission, right? I mean, that's...
Well, yeah. That too, right?
Yeah,
exactly,
so,
right.
So here's the lay of the land. Every Medicare beneficiary receives 100 days of acute Medicare days, which means they could stay up to 100 days in a skilled nursing facility.
Yep.
If they use those days, they have to remain outside of the facility for greater than 60 days in order for those to regenerate.
Hmm.
So if you use greater than 100 days in skilled nursing facility from Medicare and you go out and you're only at home for 30 days and you go back, then anything that occurs is going to come out of your pocket.
Mm-hmm. And during that 100 days, there are milestones that they have to meet, so they have to show progress.
And that's exactly right. So people rarely stay in a skilled nursing facility for 100 consecutive days, because not only it's not that the facility can just keep them there for 100 days if they choose. They have to show certain benchmarks
progress,
to Medicare,
right.
Like you said. You said it exactly right. They have to show that they're progressing, benefiting from the skilled services, which is physical therapy, occupational therapy, wound care, mm-hmm. IV antibiotics. If the skilled nursing facility is not showing that they are using one of those skilled services to benefit the patient, then they have to give what's called a last covered day, and they have to give notice to the family, And so typic average length of stay for a Medicare patient is going to be somewhere between 10 to 21 days
right.
in a skilled nursing facility.
And imagine this. My father fell, and he went into a coma. He had swelling in the brain, and they thought he was going to die. And then he didn't die, and he got a little better, and he came out of the coma. And then we go back in and out of it. And for 30 days, he went in and out of it. And during that time, he developed a bed sore so big that it was like, I hate to even describe it, it was like a couple inches deep and a couple inches wide and everything. And they had to cut it out. So now he has this big hole in his rear end, right, that's trying to heal at 93, which ain't working. And they kicked him out after 30 days. And they said, you got to take him somewhere. I said, where? I can't take him to my house. He can't go back to his house and live alone. He's in and out of a coma. His wound is needs something else. And I fought to get him into a facility that specialized in long-term wound care. And it was a fight to get him in there. It was a couple hours from where he lived. And that's where he finally passed away and died in that long-term wound care facility. It was horrible.
Well, and one of the things I'll say, I mean, it's interesting that you've described that scenario, but that's actually a really good example of the difficulties and struggles that so many families, sons and daughters, patients themselves deal with in the state of healthcare as it is today.
Yes.
So what we do in our group, I'm not going to claim that we have every solution to every problem, but what we do is try to provide a continuity of care. We try to provide an option. So what happens is when you're a patient, oftentimes you feel like you're being passed around.
And from the hospital to skilled care to someplace 2 hours away.
And no one, the days of a primary care physician who knew where you were all the time and called you up and were checking on you, those days somehow disappeared in the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, it's not the business plan.
So
my dad's primary, he had an appointment just on the books, like 3 months out. They didn't even know that he'd gone through this series of things and had died. And they called me like a month later and said, oh, we're calling to set up an appointment, your annual checkup with your father. I said, he died. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. And they hung up.
Yeah. No.
And this is his primary caregiver. He didn't even know that this sequence of things had happened and he had died.
Well, I really feel strongly that the majority of physicians are trying to do the right thing. It's just the dynamic of how healthcare has evolved and how we work within these big systems, and it's very difficult for primary care physicians to do every aspect of it because everything's become so specialized within mm-hmm. its niche.
But the term is primary. They're the ones that are supposed to be guiding you and helping you.
Let's talk about this, though, okay? So how do you do it differently?
So what we do is when we let's just take a sample scenario. If we have a patient who's in a skilled nursing facility who wants our services, and they, let's say you heard me on the radio today, just mm-hmm. to give you an example, and you said, hey, I'd like you to be my mom or dad's physician within the skilled nursing facility. It's patient choice. If they have traditional Medicare insurance, you can talk with the administrator of the facility and say, I'd like Dr. Geist to be my mom or dad's doctor. They would call my office, or you'd call my office, they'd notify us, and then the next day, they would transfer care to our practice.
But again, if you didn't know, I went through this multiple times over multiple years, and we were told there is no choice. You're stuck with Dr. Smith, who you're only going to see. Here's the other crazy thing about the skilled nursing, whoever this doctor is. He probably is assigned to half a dozen because they're big chains. So he goes and visits a bunch of them. He sees you once when you come in to make a medical evaluation, and he never sees you again. There is never a doctor that came and saw my mom, dad, or aunt in the dozens of times they were skilled nursing.
Is that scenario that Paul's describing, is that still common?
Prevalent.
Or is it something that's changed?
It has. I mean, if someone is saying that, if an administrator or a nurse is saying that you do not have choice, then that's, you know, one.
Well, they never said it that way. They just said, here's the doctor, and he now, yeah, you're under his care. Yeah.
So here's the issue is it's.
They led us to believe that.
You need to have someone, whether it's me and my group or whether it's somebody else, you need to have someone who's advocating for your loved one within the facility.
Amen.
And so that's where a group like ours is so valuable, because once you call us, we're not just the doctor who goes out and sees your loved one time. We're now your advocate. I mean, we're anything you need, we're going to go to bat for you, and we're going to try to get what you need. We're going to get you where you need to go. Say they're trying to discharge the patient with a stage 4 wound on your coccyx, like you described,
right,
for your loved one, and you don't have a place to go, well, that's where we come in, and we're talking to the administrators, the discharge planners, the case managers. We're actually talking with placement agencies, figuring out what your options are, wound care companies, mm-hmm. home health, you know, wound specialists, all of the above.
I had to do this on my own with no knowledge of where to go. And when you ask the discharge administrator, whatever they call the person, they give you maybe some brochures or something, but they basically say, I can't recommend, can't tell you what to do. You're on your own. Good luck.
So what was the driving reason behind that attitude that you basically didn't have a choice? Let's call it in the past. But what was that driving reason? Was it just the way that the organizational structure was for these facilities?
I'm speculating because I can't speak to them, but my opinion is it's a combination of people trying to run a skilled nursing facility, a business in a way that is easier, more efficient for them.
Right.
And, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's trying to, you know, figure out how to, you know, run things more efficiently.
Cost effectively.
Yeah. I mean, even skilled nursing facilities, the way I've grown my practice is I really try to put myself in the shoes of everyone I'm surrounded by. I try to put myself in the shoes of my patients, their loved ones, their family members. I also try to put myself in the shoes of the administrators and the nurses running the facilities and the communities where we go. Because I do know that I believe people are inherently good.
Yeah.
I believe people's motivations are primarily good.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a few bad eggs out there occasionally.
But it's usually the rare situation.
But I do think in healthcare, you know, healthcare has a large stigma where people are very paranoid.
Yep.
People feel like there's a lot of taking advantage of. And there's a lot of mistreatment and so on and so forth. And in some cases, for good reason, you know, those stigmas are created. But I really do believe that the majority of people in healthcare are trying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
What I can tell you just to summarize is that when you get old at a certain age and start having problems and you're going in and out of the hospital and then skilled nursing facilities and eventually end up going into independent living and then assisted living where it's really a nursing home, what happens during that phase to your medical care is a nightmare. You, for all the reasons you listed, you stop seeing your primary because you can't get to his office, his or her office, or because you're going into a facility and they don't want to come and visit you or can't or don't or won't. And then because you get moved somewhere else and your insurance gets dropped because you get too old or all these crazy things that happen. And the one person you're relying on is that primary caregiver, that doctor who was supposedly with you for all those 40 years. You get cut off completely from that and you're on your own.
But you know what, Paul, this kind of reamplifies the same reasoning we start doing the show. Okay. There is a sense that we don't want to deal with this topic. We don't want to deal with the reality that this may be a possible scenario that we find ourselves in or
right.
a loved one can find
themselves
in.
Can't happen.
Right?
Couldn't
right.
possibly
right.
happen.
But in doing so, we do ourselves a big disservice because it really comes down to educating yourself. If you educate yourself and you're open to the fact that there are other things out there and you do that proactively in advance for yourself or for the case of a loved one, okay, then you realize that there are other options. You realize that there may be some facilities that are at least of two types, one which may be a little bit more flexible in terms of your independent choice decision-making who your primary physician is. So what I'm saying is we sit here and we talk every week and we play out these scenarios about, oh, the sky is falling and, oh, it's not fair and, oh, things are not working out.
That's the way it feels when you're going through it, boy.
Yeah, but guess what? At the end of the day, we all have to take some kind of personal accountability to educate ourselves and to be open to what's happening. Because what I'm hearing here is I'm hearing you reflecting on your personal experience with your parents. And without getting specific, it was a few years back.
Yeah,
and yet that's where you're at. And here we are talking about possibly that there is another alternative.
But is
reality
this, I've
that
never
could
heard,
be basically available for people.
And that's why the show is great, because I've never heard of a mobile geriatric practice. Are there lots of those out there?
Irony is that in preparation for the show, when people say, well, who are you going to have on the show? And I said, Dr. Geisen. And they're like, oh, what's the thing? I said, it's a doctor that makes house calls.
Actually, you know, they go, wait, what? And I'm like, that yes, remember that there was a time when the image of the doctor was that they made house calls. And then that is so foreign to people now that when you say to somebody, it's a doctor that makes house calls, they go, what?
So is this totally unique?
Is this Mayberry? Where is this happening?
Are there lots of people doing this? Is this growing?
I wouldn't say lots. I mean, there's a handful of physicians that do this in Orange County and San Diego and surrounding areas. But it's definitely the vast minority. The majority of physicians are either working in a brick and mortar office as a primary care physician, or the big trend is they work as internal medicine doctors in the hospital. And then they might do some skilled nursing facility from the hospital. But then I kind of describe it as once they're discharged from the skilled nursing facility, you're kind of discharged out into the abyss of nothingness.
And so you can't drive, and you're far away, and there's nobody to help you.
Yeah. So what's the – I mean, I understand there's a need in the market. There's actually probably – you could even argue that there's a unique niche that is not being served, right, to position your business this way in a contrarian manner, right? But what is the personal drive for you doing this? Because I cannot imagine that this is just – purely, yes, I'm in the care business, and it is a practice. That there is something else, right? There's a lot of hours. There's a lot of demands that are different kinds of stresses.
Well, for sure. I mean, I talk with my wife all the time. I mean, there's other ways to make a living.
Okay.
I mean,
why this for you?
There's definitely, from a financial standpoint, I could probably do better just working as a hospitalist in the hospital, and it would be a heck of a lot less stressful.
So what's the reward?
So the honest reward and the honest drive, you know, a friend asked me that actually a few weeks back. I was driving in the car talking to him on my Bluetooth, and he asked me that. It kind of caught me off guard, and, you know, I've thought about it many times, but I hadn't thought about it lately. And, you know, the honest drive is I see a need, and I really believe there's a chance to create something better that doesn't currently exist. You know, my wife laughs at me and will sometimes give me a hard time and make fun of me, saying, you know, oh, I'm such a dreamer. Mm-hmm. I'm such this and that. And, you know, but I believe in that. I mean, I really believe that before something was created, nobody knew it existed. Right. And so
it's really the case.
Everyone sees healthcare in the current state, but it really takes some vision and it takes some drive and innovation to say, let's create something that doesn't currently exist out there.
And the reason why I kind of set you up a little bit, and the reason I asked that is because you're absolutely correct. It's funny, I'm guilty as charged too, right? I'll sit there and gripe for days about something, right? But we seem to be in this loop that we basically gripe about this and the unfairness of that and whatever. And yet, what you're doing I'm not saying it's the way it used to be, but in a way, it's going back to more closer one-on-one, hands-on, in people's personal space, rather than from the aloof distance of, you know, across a counter or, you know, on a schedule or something. It's a little bit more personal.
It also feels less like an assembly line to me, because too often now when you go to a doctor,
way to describe it,
you go there and you're queued up. There's eight of you in the lobby waiting to see him for 5 minutes.
But let's be clear. I'm not picking up. I don't think Paul is either. And we're not picking up physicians because they are also part of the system in which they are working. So that scheduling, that numbers, that, you know, how much time you spend with a patient. Yeah. Once you're within a certain type of practice, that becomes the reality in which you practice medicine.
Well, and it's very difficult to break that mold. You oftentimes feel like you're paddling up river, you know.
At some point, you say, okay, with
one paddle,
right.
And but
broken,
you know,
pedal.
In response to your question, though, you know, personal is the key word. That is a huge part of what drives me. I tell people, you know, I'm in healthcare, but I'm in the people business.
Yeah.
You know, some of the best advice I ever got was from a successful business person who was in real estate, and he told me, he said, I realized, you know, 30 years into it, he says, I'm not in the real estate business.
I'm
in the people business. Mm-hmm. And I really think every industry is the people business if you are doing your business correctly.
If you're connecting with people and you're not in the people business, you shouldn't be connecting with people.
And so the problem with healthcare that I realized when I was finishing my residency and coming out and deciding what I wanted to do was healthcare has turned into a state where people are looking to to get a contract. They're saying, how do I get a contract so I can take care of these people?
Mm-hmm.
People have forgotten good old-fashioned, let's go out care. And actually win over the people because they like you and they think you're the best doctor.
Yeah, it's not about contracts. It's about relationships.
And so that is kind of the forgotten aspect mm-hmm. of healthcare. And so, and people think that that day of healthcare has gone away, but I'd argue that it hasn't. There still is a huge section of the population. You know, I've been sitting in skilled nursing facilities working on a chart at the desk next to a nurse, and I've had a son or daughter walk up to me and say, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
I say, I'm Dr. Geis, and I'm here seeing patients. And they say, can you be my mom's doctor?
Mm-hmm.
That happens. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you another question, though? Because I think this goes to the heart of what Rod's trying to say. With personal care, don't you get more time? If you go to somebody's house, because one of the things that drove my mother, dad, and my aunt currently crazy is you're queued up in a waiting room. They're always late because there's 6, 7 ahead of you, and you're in there for a maximum of 5 minutes. I mean, you see the doctor looking at his watch, and he starts heading out, and I've literally had to block the door and say, my aunt still has a question, and they're like, time's up.
Yeah, no, we typically spend, it depends. I mean, we see our patients when we have a patient in a community, we stop into that community at least once a week, if not twice a week. So, and then when we perform a patient visit, I mean, we're spending anywhere from 25 minutes to an hour and a half with that patient.
Unheard of. I'm telling you, 5 minutes is the max you get with most primary caregivers.
You literally feel like there's a timer.
It is a timer.
Well, and
they'll come knock on the door.
And here's the thing, you know, just to, you know, come to the defense of those physicians. They're working within a system.
Yeah,
they have someone cracking the whip up in upper management,
right,
telling them that if they don't see a certain number of patients, then
they're out.
They're out. And so it's, you know, the system's been created and it's being perpetuated. And the reality is, if you take the proper time and you document appropriately the complexity of the patient, and you do a really good job, Medicare and insurance will reimburse you appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
There's no secret. You know, physicians and practitioners are always looking for that secret. You know, how can I do less work and
make more money
and be productive? And I think everybody's looking for that secret, right?
But
the reality is there's no secret to it. It takes good old-fashioned hard work,
yep,
taking the time, one patient at a time, focusing on the person you're with, and so on and so forth. And that's really, you know, the foundation of who we are.
You know, it's fascinating. I think everybody who's either in business, mostly if you're in your own business or if you're in a very personal contact kind of business, at some point in your career, and I think probably even in your life, you come to a crossroads. And the crossroads is, which way do you go? Do you go on volume or do you go on quality? And sometimes the two, there's a point where the two cannot intersect anymore. There's a point where you have to make a decision. What is the contentment factor for you? And that's a very personal answer, usually. Like, you really got to dig deep inside, right?
Sure.
Because there's another factor to this, which I think is just astounding. We talk about crazy costs on medical. We talk about, you know, we needing to put in a policy so that there's an attempt to lower readmission, right? So basically saying, take care of them correctly the first time so that maybe you can lower readmission at the hospitals, right? It's nuts that we have to put those guidelines and benchmarks in to try to correct the curve, right? The end of the day, if you took the time and if you were fortunate enough to have the latitude of somewhat preventive medicine, everybody wins.
Yeah.
The cost goes down. The lack, the need for medical care maybe is prolonged. You know, that you don't need that intensive care, that healthier approach. And it's fascinating because all the literature, all the pitching that happens from organized medicine tends to be about thriving. I'm not picking any particular company, right? But thriving, you know, preventive, all this stuff. But when it comes down to practice, we're getting better. But when it comes down to practice, we're still sort of stuck in that mold that it's about volume and turnover.
And it's not about being smart
about how do you deliver on this and when you deliver on it so that everybody actually wins, starting with the patient.
And yeah, let me just give you two quick examples of volume. One was my aunt for a number of years. She has this rare blood cancer. She would go to a specialist, an oncologist. many's the time he would come in, because he had a huge practice. There were 50 people in the waiting room. He made millions off of this thing here. And he was good at what he did. But he got it down to, he only was in there for such a short period of time, I don't even know if he knew who the patient was, quite frankly. Because one time he came in, I've seen him do this a couple times, and he would start dictating into his little dictation recorder here. Just saw Florence Keating, and he started reading the notes, and he hadn't asked her a question. He walked in and started dictating like that was over the minute he arrived. And my aunt would stop and wave and say, "Hello, don't you want to say hi to me here?" And he's like, "Just a minute." And he would start dictating, and he was in and out before he could even really ask her. And then the other point I want to make is when you get older, and I used to have this frustration with my mom and dad and now with my aunt, they don't want to make it quick. They're scared. They slow down as they get older. So they want to tell you this long-winded story, this long-winded explanation like I am now here.
Yeah.
And they want to. And the doctor's like, "Just cut to the point. You know, what do you want to know? You got a lump. Here's what it is. Take this pill. Goodbye."
So that's the reason. You're just getting older on the air every week.
In front of you.
I see how it is. Okay, I get it now. Cut to the chase.
No. So they want it longer, and the doctors want it shorter, and there's a tension immediately. I've seen it for years. The doctor wants to get in and get out as fast as they can, and my dad would literally jump up sometimes to block the door and say, "Wait a minute, I still don't understand. I still got a question. I'm old. I don't get what you're saying."
And do we age the same way we used to? I mean, that's the other thing, is the expectation of the patient now, or in an incoming group of people, the same as in the past? Or is that going to put a different spin and reality on how medicine needs to be practiced?
Well, I mean, you know, we were talking about this before the show. A lot of it is the psychology of the family member and are the generation before the senior, right? Because the reality is, what I do as a geriatric physician and a house call physician, I'm interacting with the sons and daughters of these patients, you know, 90% of the time. And the reality is, the senior, it's not just about what the senior wants. It's whether this is good or bad, I'm just stating facts about the nature of healthcare and how it works.
Right.
You really do have to interact and go with what the family member wants, who may at that point be the medical decision maker.
Absolutely.
Who may be doing that. So,
and may be footing the bill if it's out of pocket.
Exactly. So a lot of it is, you're looking at the dynamics and the psychology of the generation after that, and thinking, what's their expectation? What's the reality? What do they think is going to occur?
You see, here's the interesting opportunity with that, right? Is that you basically are educating an incoming group of people.
Yeah.
Right. You're basically planting the seeds, and this is what I'm talking about. It's interesting because at moments like that, that person that you're talking to, 20 years, 15 years, whatever the time period may be sitting right exactly where their parent is today.
Yeah.
But now they have been empowered, and if they have all their faculties at that point, they've been empowered with a knowledge base that their parent maybe did not have.
Sure.
So that is an opportunity for everybody who interacts with that family.
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting point. One of the things I try to educate our family members on that we take care of their loved ones is, when they get to that point at end of life, you know, there's certain things that is on everyone's mind.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing is fear. Mm-hmm. There's fear of being alone at
tremendous
that stage.
Tremendous fear. Fear falling, fear of everything. Yeah.
And the other one is fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
The fear of, how am I going to pass? How am I, not just how am I going to pass, but how is it going to be the final weeks, the final month, the final hours, you know? And family members, and it's not just the patient, but the sons and daughters of those family members have a lot of fear of that as well. It's one thing to, you know, we're a culture where we want to have a plan. We want to have a game plan. And it's, you know, even though it's difficult, we can at least have a game plan when mom or dad is in an assisted living community or mom or dad is in a skilled nursing facility. Mm-hmm. But we're always looking at the next step. But the unknown is, what is going to occur as they get towards end of life? And oftentimes, that's the most complicated time. And that is one of the biggest issues with healthcare in our system, is our loved ones who go back and forth from the hospital at least four or five times in their final 3 months of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what the patient wants. Mm-hmm. It's not what the family member wants. And it's not what we want as healthcare providers. And so, at least not with what I do in my practice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know.
Not even what the system wants. It's expensive.
I don't know the statistics right off the top of my head, but it's a very high percentage of Medicare dollars that are spent in the final 3 months of life.
And you know, the funny thing is it all, I think, or in part stems from an issue of denial, right? We don't deal with this. We had the folks from O'Connor on here last week. I think it was last week, wasn't it, Paul?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mortuary people.
Yeah, and we start off with the fact that nobody says a person died in society. We all pass away. We all go to the...
We can't even deal with the reality that they died. We have to sugarcoat it and make it... We're all still 6 years old, and we can't tell little Timmy that somebody died.
Other societies have a sense of ritual, a sense of this is as much part of life as living.
Yeah,
we don't do that. And so when it comes to those final 3 months that you're talking about, it's like total avoidance and denial on whatever needs to be done. It's like it's almost like you're trying to undo something. And we're not doing anybody a favor.
Well, and that it's interesting you say that, because that was the point I wanted to go to, was that's what I educate families on. When they get to that point in the last 6 months, 3 months, they want to try so hard to reverse the tide. The huge part of it is denial. And I'm not trying to fault them, because when it's your own mom or dad,
yeah, absolutely,
it's different. And so
you won't even really know how you're going to react until you find yourself.
And I get that. I lost my own father to colon cancer 5 years ago, and I saw him go through the hospice process, and I was a young guy, and so I've lived it, and I have a level of compassion there. But I try to educate these families and say, don't work so hard fighting the tide on every little last detail that you cannot control. Enjoy the time you have with them.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, if I could do a report after the fact for the majority of patients who have a loved one die, I guarantee the majority of them would go back and say, man, I wish I wouldn't have...
The regret.
I wish I wouldn't have spent so much time worrying about this lab result that was a little off. I wish I wouldn't have worried so much about this x-ray that showed this little finding.
Yep.
I wish I wouldn't have driven my mom back to the hospital 3 days before she passed away.
Yep.
They would have looked back and said, I should have just enjoyed the time I had.
Sitting there in the same space with my parent. Yeah.
One of the other things, though, that adds to the anxiety and fear and pressure at that point in time is you don't know what to do. Suddenly you're being asked to understand lab results that you have never seen before. Suddenly you're being asked to make hard choices. Do you want to go through the operation or do you want to not? They could die or they could not die. Suddenly you're being faced with costs that you had no idea of, funeral costs and nursing home costs and end-of-life costs and all these things that you weren't prepared for. The choices that come at you at that point in time, I can only tell you, are overwhelming. I'm going to choke up here, but you get... I remember sitting there with my dad when he fell and he went into, I raced out there. I get there in time. He's in a coma. And the doctor walks up and says, what do you want to do? Do you want to operate or not? And I said, well, I don't know. What's the choice? If we operate, there's a 50% chance he'll die and he'll probably be blind. So what's your other choice? We can do nothing. He'll probably just die. Okay, what's the third choice here? You know, so I did nothing at that moment, partly because I couldn't make a decision. Am I going to guarantee my father comes out dead or blind, or am I just going to do punt and hope that the better? And he recovered for a while. And so I thought, wow, okay, I got spared that one. And I can give you a dozen.
That's funny that you put it that way, Paul, that you were spared that one, right?
I was spared that one.
Yeah, because there's no preparation. There's not even the embracing of the idea that that will be a point. And I think it's really funny, because if you actually embrace the fact that at some point in time,
he's going to go.
Your parents are not going to be there.
Right.
Right. And by the way, we keep talking about this topic, you know, from an aging perspective and sort of a natural aging and passing because of, getting up there in age. But it could happen to somebody who's 13. I mean, what it really tells you is you got to embrace the fact that dying is part of life.
Right.
And so any time that you have, any moment that you have, not to shy away, shed away all responsibilities of, modern living and making a living and all that stuff, But you really got to appreciate the time you have with people, whether they be 15, whether they be 50, whether they be 150. We really do not do ourselves a favor when we basically do all of this thing like it's something that could be pushed off and pushed off and pushed off. Talk about it. We got Thanksgiving coming up tomorrow. Right, we got holidays coming up. These are opportunities not necessarily to sit down with Aunt Edna and talk about dying, but to at least actually sit down with Aunt Edna and enjoy Aunt Edna. Actually have a personal connection, like a real meaningful connection. Put your phone down. Don't text. You know, Aunt Edna doesn't have to reply to you on Skype. You know, it just connect with people because you said your father passed away 5 years ago?
Yeah, he passed away 5 years ago from colon cancer, and he was only 63 years old.
Perfect example.
And, you know, and we never thought in a million years that...
David Cassidy,
you know,
today, what was it, 63?
67.
That was going to occur. But when you're faced with your own mortality or the mortality of a loved one,
yeah,
you really do... You start to live in the moment. You really do start to appreciate what you're doing now. And if we could start living that way now.
And what would help. And do it from a point of the joy of living in the now. Not the fear of I may not have tomorrow. I know it's just a slightest twist on the coin, right? But there's a major difference. If you approach living life today with the joy of the fact that you have today versus the fact that I don't know if I will be around tomorrow.
Well, and one of the things, if I could emphasize, if anyone's listening, one of the things elderly women or men who are afraid or alone, it's something I'm extremely passionate about from my own mom,
mm-hmm.
you know, my own mother, who I see firsthand her going through that as a widow, and her biggest fear is being alone.
Yeah.
And being sick and being alone. And so it drives me when I see people who don't have someone to call on, someone to lean on, someone to say, you know, to walk in the front door, shake their hand, look them in the eye and say, I'm here, I'm going to take care of you, and I'm not going away.
Wow.
See, I knew it. Go ahead.
And that, you just don't get that anymore.
And so that's
what drives me. Yeah. And that's what we're about. And so
I knew if we opened that door, I was going to get personal. I knew he was going to come through because no, I mean,
and that's what's missing. I'm telling you,
this is,
he's absolutely right. My aunt is, she feels nobody cares about her. Nobody listens to her anymore. She has nobody to talk to. My mom, my dad, we all went through that because more and more, less time, can't get there, change doctors, change plans, change everything.
There's no way, okay, to spend time with someone without spending time with someone. You can't basically schedule in 10 minutes with your parents and feel like I crossed that off my to-do list. That's
right.
Not spending time with people, right? We talk about it on this radio show. Okay, I go out every time we go out, everybody goes, oh, we just had such a great time. Yeah, you know why? Because we sat down for an hour and actually just had a conversation.
Right.
And we kind of didn't have a to-do list. We didn't have an agenda we had to cross items off. We kind of had a loose direction of where we were, but it was really a coming together to meet and know each other and build a relationship based on let's see where the journey takes us. We don't do that as a society anymore. You got perfect opportunity. Anybody who's watching or listening, okay, this is your homework. I shouldn't even say it's homework, but it's your homework, okay? And I want to report on this next week, right? You got Thanksgiving coming up, right? Take the time to sit around the table. Don't just show up at the table when the turkey hits the table and then basically can't wait to get off in front and watch the game. There's opportunities that you're going to see family members that you may not have had a chance to see for a long time. Some of them you may not necessarily see by Christmas or even next year. So take the time to actually have a depth of relationship with people because it reflects in your work. Dr. Geis, I mean, I'm telling you, I'm listening to what you're saying, and you're saying, you know, all this, and we joke about the house calls and stuff like that. But really, underneath it all is a genuine sense of care because, I had grandparents, right? All my grandparents have passed away. I have my father, who's in their 80s, right? I've always grown up and lived around extended families. It's that that drives me to do this show because it has no connection to what I do for a living. But it's this conversation that we should have. And sometimes it's joyful. about celebrating somebody's life who's, you know, decided to pursue a path of passion for 30 years, and now they're in their 70s and 80s, and they're still very energized because of that decision. And in some cases, we're talking about end of life, and it's still, you know, facing it with somewhat of a joy, right? So these conversations are very, very important, and as a society, I think we try to shy away from them. And, you know, thanks to things like these, we can actually hide in our own bubble even a little easier these days.
Yeah.
And it's not just a conversation that we need to have with our loved ones while there's time still here. It's what he's talking about, reestablishing conversations and connections between doctor and patient. I just feel like it's an automated assembly line, and there's very little personal connection, very little time spent. You got to go to them, and you stand in a line, and they see you for a couple minutes. And next, there isn't, at a moment when you need more information and more fear to face the fear and to face the uncertainties, to face all the questions, you get less and less.
Paul, society used to be where you had a relationship with that person across the counter that may have been a butcher, may have a baker, have been, you know, whatever, right? So at some point, the profession that you provide, the service you provide to people, isn't the relationship. That's just what you do and you give to one another, right? So the doctor-patient, we keep referring to it as this doctor-patient, this camp and this camp, you know, kind of like, you know, somebody's wearing a red jersey, the other one wearing a blue jersey or something, right? What we're missing is that in order to genuinely convey care, not just medical, you know, solutions.
Advice, yeah.
Okay? Is you have to shed that, you have to get close, you have to get in that personal space. Otherwise, you know, what's the alternative? I mean, how do you do
that? The alternative is telemedicine, where we're just going to phone it in and somebody's going to look at you and say, show me the sore, tell you what to do, and you're going to have no connection. And next week it'll be somebody else on the line.
Yeah, but we're so hungry for connection, Paul, that even with live video, live Facebook feeds, whatever, you know, we feel more connected to people because we see them and we can interact with them.
Sure.
Then how many people, it's a joke, right? How many people don't even know their neighbors? How many people don't even, like, knock on their neighbors and see, hey, do you have a place to go for Thanksgiving today?
I don't. Yeah. I don't know half of my neighbors.
I mean, that's the society we live in. And I'm not knocking anybody, but all I'm saying is that we could probably do better, at least if we take personal accountability for ourselves to do better. And let's give the website to Dr.
Let's give the website.
We got into this and we never gave the website out.
Yeah.
It's www.geissmed.com.
Can I only tell you this? And in all sincerity, you're doing God's work here. I'm a good Irish Catholic. That is, I'm pleased to hear that somebody's out there worried about the seniors and willing to come to them when they can't go anywhere, when they're lost and fearful and feel forgotten. And you're seeking them out and coming to them and spending time with them. Oh, my God. When can you come to Palm Desert and the thing? Because I got a 93-year-old aunt who would think you're the...
We're working on getting out there.
The answer.
Were you about to say cat's meow?
The cat's meow.
Yeah, I think you were going to say that. Right. No, look, I want to just take this opportunity. You know, Dr. Geis was acknowledged as outstanding physician at the 2017 Senior Hero Award, and... You know, that's put on by Senior Hero Award, but Senior Serve is very much in part of it, and it's a great event every year. If you haven't been, it's where the community, where the senior care community or those who are in servicing for our seniors come together, and we acknowledge those unsung heroes that are out there doing stuff. There's a lot of people out there that genuinely care and give them, and a lot of people we both know that were there, you know. Senior Serve, Alzheimer's, OC, I mean, there's just some people that just salt of the earth genuinely care and give and give and give. So I don't want to sound like, you know, we're coming off this show like we're just picking on people as for being kind of very mechanical and very assembly line.
But there is a system that's set up to back that way.
But I think the example of Dr. Geis, and not to make you feel uncomfortable, but I think the example of Dr. Geis shows you that you can chart a different path.
Yeah,
you can chart a different path, and the rewards may be a mixture of financial, monetary, but other rewards and other things that actually also feed your soul. A lot of the people that I mentioned are out there doing that. They're doing it in a volunteer capacity. They do it in community outreach. You know, there's such a need out there that as much as people that are out there doing it, we need like quadruple the number of people out there doing it. But just have the courage to pursue a different path if you feel that there is a different path that's your calling. Paul put it, you know, I think this is your calling, to be honest, Dr. Geis.
Well, I feel strongly that it is. I mean, I definitely eat, sleep, and drink it, you know, but it does. I mean, I really do feel like I don't always have all the answers, and I don't always know what the next step is to improve and grow and expand our influence and do what we do. But I definitely feel strongly that it's what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think it will show in the next 10, 20, 30 years as we change the way healthcare is run out in the senior community.
The baby boomers will change it. We've changed everything else. We changed what it was like to be a teenager.
You know,
we created what it was like to be a young adult, a yuppie. And now we're going to demand a different level of healthcare.
Yeah, I used to think that, and then I spent the last 3 years sitting in this room with you.
Yeah,
right?
Well.
You guys all talk a big game.
We talk
about
a big game, but we don't do much.
But you guys are scared, too.
We're scared.
You're scared. For the first time probably in your generation's
history.
First time
in our generation.
You guys are scared.
Yes, we're scared.
Well, and before I go, I want to just give a shout-out to Kyla from Cadence Hospice.
Wow.
Stick your face in the
She didn't even want to get on camera here.
She didn't want to get on camera, but she introduced me to OC Talk Radio and brought us together today. So I really appreciate they provide an excellent service. And, you know, we talked about the end of life and hospice, but they really do provide an excellent service.
So what's the website? Come on, give us the website for your company. Cadence, like
C. You got to do it on camera, though.
Cadence, C-A-D-E-N-C-E. Cadence.
You're not going to make her do it on camera?
No, she didn't want
to. Okay. And I do want to give a shout out to Deborah Pearson, too, that, thank you, Deborah. It is Thanksgiving, and we want to just give you thanks for helping us secure such great guests. It really is an awesome thing that I get rewarded with every week, to be able to sit here and actually just spend time with people. You know, get off the rat race, get out of the car, Orange County, and actually just spend some time with people. If I can only get Paul to put in an espresso machine in here, I'll be set.
There it is. Well, it's the next phase of the rat life.
But he's setting up for the Christmas holiday party.
Well, truly, I mean, if you ever want to have me back, I love talking about this stuff. I mean, it really is. It's such a pertinent topic. It's such a hot topic in our society.
Sure.
The baby boomer generation.
Can I ask you one quick question before we go? How does the medical establishment react to this? Are you a threat to the doc in the box chains that the hospitals are spinning out?
Or are they even paying attention?
Or the
that's an interesting question. You know, the short answer is I don't think so. You know, there's a lot of patients out there, and there's a lot of people that need help.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, this senior population, which we serve day in and day out, is one of the most complex populations in order to take care of well.
Mm-hmm.
And even the hospital systems and the big chains and the big companies, they don't have a solution. This is, you know, I be careful what I say on the air, but if I could be in the boardrooms of some of these large companies, I guarantee this is at the top of their agenda. Is they're putting programs and processes in place to try to combat this, but it's very difficult to do, because from growing a business that focuses on senior care, mm-hmm. and is personal, within our organization, my own company, it's very personal.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can grow and scale, mm-hmm. and expand to other geographies such as Palm Desert, which you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. is if I provide an excellent physician and provider who can do and replicate what I do here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very difficult to do.
But it would seem to be a trend, because we've got this Uberization going on, which is the idea that not just the gig economy, but things come to you. My aunt gets groceries brought to her now through Albertsons, okay, home delivery. She has Meals on Wheels that come and bring food to her. And it's fighting this resistance we've had for years, where we're going to accumulate everybody. We're going to put all the seniors into a place, and they come to the care rather than the care comes to them.
It is, that is our society, and there's a lot of I don't want to say problems. There's a lot of things you have to overcome in doing our model,
mm-hmm.
and one of those is communicating well and setting expectations in an appropriate place. You know, for example, you know, a patient might go and have to wait for 2 hours to see their regular primary care physician. Well, we tell someone that we might be there between 12 and 1 o'clock, you know, and if we're held up on the other side of town because someone had an emergency, and we get there at 1:15. You know, sometimes we get flack for it. Yeah. And the reality is, you know, it's, you know, there's a reason why, you know, cable repairmen give you a 6-hour window from when, right. from when they're going to be there.
Yeah.
Because when you're traveling and you're a mobile entity,
it's a different logistics.
There's a whole host of variables that can come into play. But again, I see that. I see what is one problem point as a challenge and an opportunity to make. Again, I go back to my vision of creating something that does not currently exist. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult, but it's also very
But it's a
rewarding.
Fundamental different approach. Our whole life is built on I go to some place to get a service or to get something. But at some point in my life, I can't travel. I can't drive. I can't move. And why not bring that stuff
back
to me?
Or my life is so hectic and so full that I basically can't notch out that time to do it. I mean, you know, that's a bigger question for another show.
Right.
But I think, Paul, to your point, as we become more of an Uber and on-demand society, when it comes to certain infrastructure industries, and I'm looking at medicine as being one of those, the billing, the way that it gets paid for, is very institutionalized in a certain way. And being in an Uber on-demand situation, I don't think this infrastructure is there to support that as an option. Now, as more and more people demand it, maybe it will change, but you're talking about a large ocean liner, you know, that it's very difficult to make navigational maneuvering.
Yes.
Right? And so somebody like Dr. Geis that has a smaller, vessel is able to adjust, but he even just admitted to you on the air here that, you know, in order to grow, he's faced with that now challenge in reality, that the only way to do that meaningfully and truthfully, holding true to his vision of what he built, is to find that absolute physician that can deliver the same way. And, you know, it's a hard one. I mean, I know from my own practice, right? You want to grow it and you're so engaged and involved in it, to find someone that is going to emulate what your approach
does it
is
your way.
That's a hard, and at some point you got to let it go a little bit, but yeah, that's that crossroads again. Do I grow in order to cover more territory and grow my business, but in the course of that risk potentially diluting a little bit of my vision?
I want to have 5 more community radio stations, but I can't find anybody that runs it like I do. So how am I going to have Long Beach Talk Radio or Palm Springs Talk Radio if I can't get somebody I trust to go do it the same way we do it here? So
and that means you know what that means? That means that you feel passionately about what you do, and that's great. But hey, maybe your destiny is not to have 5 radio stations. Maybe your destiny is to have 1 radio station that you really absolutely
do well
at.
Yeah.
We'll find out. Thank you for coming. Give us the website again.
It's www.geissmed.com.
Wonderful idea. Innovative. Seems so obvious. At some point when the people can't come to you, you come to them.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Dr. Geis. Really a pleasure. Paul, thank you for all that you do. And I want to just give everybody my contact again. You can reach me at The Rad Life on Facebook, or you can reach me at Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantus, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, @gmail.com. You can also call me. I answer most of the time, 949-212-8299. That's my cell. And I really just want to say thank you, everybody. It's Thanksgiving tomorrow, so go spend time with your family and loved ones. And if you don't have anybody nearby, just reach out to your neighbor. There are other people that are just hungry. We as human beings are wired for contact and connection. So don't lose the practice of doing that, because that's a muscle you might not gain back if you stop practicing it.
And thanks for listening.
And thanks for listening to the radio show. And thanks for all our guests this year. We couldn't do this without you.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.